Democracy Now! Asking you to support KPFK. One of the best ways you can do it is simply by becoming a sustainer, pledging $10 or more each month. In that way, you help to protect this independent radio station. And sign up today.
You can join KPFK's sustainer program by logging on to kpfk.org.
Hi, this is Lisa Gay Hamilton, and you're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week, we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like. Acting Like Women is a new feature-length documentary about feminist art, performance art, and community building at the Women's Building in 1970s LA. And we're going to hear all about it today from the filmmakers Sherry Gaulke and Anne Golden. We actually interviewed artist-director Sherry and co-producer Anne about making this film back in November 2021. And you were both very much at the beginning stage, but here it is, a fully formed and really amazing 90-minute film. So we're here to celebrate the completion and the release and the upcoming premiere in LA, which is very exciting. So welcome both to Feminist Magazine.
Thank you for having us back.
We promised, and here we are. I'm just so thrilled to do this. So it's a very personal film, but also very much about feminist activism and the history and the art and the era. Sherry, tell our listeners just a little bit about how you envisioned this film and, you know, how you put the pieces together.
Well, in 2019, I was retiring from my full-time teaching job and thought, I need a big project to take on, and thought, I want to make my first feature documentary. I'd been making short documentaries at that point, and I thought, I need a big story to tell. What would it be? Oh, it could be the story of the Woman's Building, because I moved to Los Angeles in 1975 to be part of the Woman's Building, and it changed my life. It was a transformative experience for myself and so many women. When I began to explore that as a topic, I quickly realized it was way too big of a topic because the Woman's Building was so many things. It was a public center for women's culture in downtown Los Angeles, and it hosted writers. It had a graphic design studio. It had huge galleries, and visual artists came, and there was a performance art space, and you know, in the early years, Sisterhood Bookstore was there, and there was a cafe, and it was this, you know, a huge cultural institution that so many people came through over the years. So I thought, okay, got to narrow the scope here and realize that what was most important to me and the thing that I really saw a profound contribution to be able to talk about is feminist performance art, because performance art was this brand new medium, and out of the Woman's Building came such innovative work that was dealing with topics, issues that women were facing then and now, and exploring them in ways that were different than what we were seeing in the art world at the time, and kind of changing the very role of art in culture. And I thought the Woman's Building's contribution to that part of art needed to be documented and explored and documented and presented.
Right. And I wasn't aware how new that at that time the whole concept of performance art was, and also how well it fitted into feminist art, because it was about using your bodies and claiming your whole selves, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, women's bodies were something that were the subject of art, usually depicted by male artists. And as artists, our bodies were not in the museums as creators ourselves. And so there was also the whole thing of discrimination that was happening at that time in the art world and in the world in general, where there were very few opportunities for women.
Right. And you were also at the Women's Building and part of performance art collectives. I saw you all over in the film. Tell us your entry into the Women's Building and that piece of time.
Well, sure. I also came to the Women's Building in 1975, where I met Sherry. We were both students in the Feminist Studio Workshop, which was a college level and postgraduate program. So we actually both earned our master's degrees through Goddard College while we were studying in the Feminist Studio Workshop. And Suzanne Lacey was one of my teachers in the performance art section. And that's how I got introduced to performance art, was through her and other students like Sherry that had been doing performance art before they came to the Women's Building. But what I really loved about performance art was that it was very immediate. You could think up a performance and actually create something, you know, within a day or two, as opposed to painting was a medium that I had been working in. I would spend weeks, months on a painting. It took a long time. And with performance art, you could immediately act out and express or go through some kind of transformation, you know, right there. It was a very immediate process.
Yeah, what I loved in the film was also how you showed that it gave birth to performance art as protest, which we now think of as like part of feminist protest wherever we see it. You had that clip from "You Are the Rapist," that was sort of came out of Argentina in the last few years. And you can see very much where the thread goes and where it came from, right?
Absolutely. I mean, with performance art, I mean, we were feminist artists, and performance artists gave us this opportunity to bring feminist issues to a public. You know, if we weren't going to be shown in the galleries and museums, we started to think about, well, who is our audience and who's going to galleries and museums? Is this an elite audience that maybe we need to speak? If we're interested in creating social change, maybe we need to speak to a broader audience. So with performance, we were able to go away from the institutions and bring the work into the streets, and not just do street performance, but to, like Suzanne Lacey and Leslie Labowitz, you know, and all their work with Ariadne, Social Art Network, doing pieces about violence against women and putting them on the front steps of City Hall and staging it for the media, so that the audience then becomes people watching television who are watching these women critique, you know, record companies' representation of women, or critique how reporting on the Hillside Strangler is happening and the way it's showing women as victims. So it was this really exciting time to just feel like we were able to get our message out to more people.
Yeah, and that was also a great point of actually becoming aware of how to use the media, like what will the TV station actually pick up, and, you know, how you shaped your work around that. I thought that was really quite brilliant. And also, you know, a precursor to what we do now.
Yes. And one of our producers says, you know, feminist performance art from the 70s and 80s was creating a language that artists and activists are using today. And one of the reasons we wanted to make this film is to just show that there's a history, there's a backstory on what people are doing effectively today. It's not to say that what we did is not continuing, it is, but a lot of times we don't know the legacy of where things came from as women, as artists, and, you know, just to keep making the world a better place, we need to know, you know, especially within movements, you know, we need to know the history of our strategies, because these are strategies.
Exactly. I really loved the Arlene Raven quote about the function of feminist art is to raise consciousness, invite dialogue, and transform culture. Had a little inner cheer at that moment. I'd like to ask both of you, though, also, there was a quote, I think it was Suzanne Lacy in the film, who said about her 3 weeks in May rape maps and performances, "We assumed if you knew about it, you would change it." And where are we now with that? Anne, I don't know if you'd like to start on that one.
Oh, that's a tough one. I think at the time we did raise consciousness and we did transform culture about issues like, for example, rape, which is a big, heavy, hard to face challenge. But today it feels like we have slid backwards as women in terms of issues like just body autonomy, very simple things. I think it also shows that you can't let your guard down. We have to constantly be inviting these dialogues and attempting to transform culture.
Yeah, I think there's a quote about that, that liberation is an ongoing piece of work. It's not a one-time act, right? Sherry?
Yeah, well, no, I was just thinking about, I'm always a glass half full kind of gal, even though I am in great despair over the state of the world and the ways in which, we are losing our rights that we fought so hard to gain. But I then compare it to the 70s and think about how, back then, and these are some of the things that we bring up in the film, that in 1972, it was legal for a husband to beat his wife in the state of California. I mean, that's mind blowing. And also, and back then it was a woman had to get her husband's permission to have a bank account or a credit card. So, that feels like the dark ages. And when I think about back on violence against women, I think of the important work we did back then of consciousness raising groups, CR groups, where we began to share our experience with each other. We had been so isolated as women back then from each other. We'd been taught to be in competition with each other for men, and we were taught that everything bad that happened to us was our own fault. So when we first began to share experiences of sexual violence, for example, we were shocked. Wait, this thing I've been keeping secret or this thing that happened to me had actually happened to other women. And then I remember back then learning that 1 in 3 women were raped. And it's just like all of a sudden your mind is blown. And I feel like nowadays, these are things we talk about all the time. There is consciousness about rape and violence against women. There's consciousness about how images perpetuate that. Just ways in which, men are taught to behave or have certain attitudes. And I feel like it's all part of our conversation now. Back then, it was all new. It was brand new information, and it was shocking. And we were determined to let people know about it.
Yeah, and I think what's so vital about making films like this right now is that I feel like the current younger, new generation of activists and feminists are hungry to know how it was done before, what can they learn from it. Not that they're not going to do it their own way, but that's not history that we're taught anywhere else. So that's, yet another reason why this film is so important, I feel.
Yeah, it's hard, sometimes you don't want to be the old lady going, "You should really know, back then we," kind of
right.
Like that. And I think one of our biggest fears and biggest hopes was we really hoped that a younger generation would respond well to this film. Mm-hmm. And so far, we have gotten such a great response from younger women. Older women, of course, recognize exactly what we're talking about and feel very affirmed by it and love sharing their own experience. But to have all these younger women at our screenings, we've been at Bentonville Film Festival in Arkansas, which is the festival that Gina Davis started 12 years ago to raise awareness and give more opportunities to women filmmakers. And then we we went straight from there to Frameline, which is the largest and oldest gay and lesbian LGBTQ plus film festival in the world. And that was so gratifying to have such a huge audience and great response. But in both places, it's just been so wonderful to have that younger generation being so excited and say, like, I never knew about this. Right. This is so amazing. And thank you. And, but like you said, I mean, everybody is going to do it in their own way and their new way. And we applaud that and we support that. And we want to just make this contribution to keep it moving, you know, keep it moving.
100%. I've been talking to Sherry Gorky and Anne Golden about the new feature-length documentary, Acting Like Women. So the film actually has the voices of over 50 artists. I mean, it's amazing the number of interviews you all did, including, you know, the founders of the Women's Building and Judy Chicago and Arlene Raven and Sheila de Bretville, and then also the works of some of these amazing groups that came out of the Women's Building, performance art groups, the Waitresses, Sisters of Survival, the Feminist Art Workers. That, I think, is kind of this joyful heart of the film, seeing their different performances. And tell us about how, first of all, how you chose who you interviewed. And then let's also talk about some of those groups. Anne.
Well, Sherry and I both, you know, lived through the performance art of Los Angeles in the 1970s and 80s. So we also went to all these artists' performances and they came to ours. So we knew who the artists were that we, you know, wanted to include because we know them personally. And everyone was very generous with their time and giving us their images that they had. Because, as you know, the documentation was a little on the thin side. We didn't have cell phones and a lot of digital media back then. So there's a lot of still photography and some video. But it was a challenge because, you know, it took us a long time to interview everybody and then to weave the stories together. But we decided to use Sherry's voice as the main storyteller, which gave the film an arc and a heroine that you could follow through the story.
Yeah, and that worked so well because it was personal and present, but a narrative voice. You know, the two parts worked so well. Yeah, and all of these groups, Sherry, tell our listeners a little bit about these fabulous performance art groups. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and also I think that was one of the great contributions of the Women's Building to feminist performance art and art in general is this idea of collaboration. Mm. Because at that time in the art world, you know, the image of an artist is the solo male artist struggling alone in their studio. And so being women was one thing, but working together, you know, because it was all about your identity as an artist and sort of this myth of the artist. And for us to work together was so against that grain. In fact, I remember really struggling in the early years of like how to even get recognized. You know, should we just go under the moniker of the name of the group, or should we say, you know, feminist art workers colon and then list all the artists in the group? And it becomes very bulky. So I see why the art world maybe likes to keep it simple. I don't know. But these groups were amazing. I mean, I'll let Anne talk about the Waitresses because she was one of the co-founders, but Feminist Art Workers was a group that, you know, used feminist education techniques combined with performance art and went around the country to bring workshops to women that could not come to the Women's Building. Sisters of Survival was a group in the 80s that responded to the nuclear threat, and we wore nuns' habits in the spectrum of the rainbow, and did a big project called End of the Rainbow, where we went to Europe and networked with artists and activists in the U.S. and in Europe. And Mother Art was a group that was formed of women who were all mothers, and they were unhappy with the lack of childcare and things like that at the early Women's Building, because a lot of us were young women that most of the women probably did not have children, but there were some who did. And so they came together to, you know, share their struggles and experiences and joys of being mothers, and also just shining a light on mothers. Waitresses, Anne, talk about the waitresses and how wonderful.
So the waitresses were born in Suzanne Lacey's performance art class, where she asked each of us to come tomorrow and do a performance about something about your life. And I had been a waitress for many years after college to support myself. And I did this performance, and Jerry Allen was in the class, and we got to talking. She had also waitressed her way through college. And we just realized we had so many experiences as waitresses that were very similar to experiences of women just in general out in culture, being, for example, being harassed. You know, you're there to do your job, but both the customers and the bosses would harass us. And just things, stereotypes that women are expected to always be pleasant and smiling and serving you, you know, that you're in some ways the customer's slave. So we started talking about all the experiences that we shared, and decided we wanted to form a group called the Waitresses, and invited other artists that had been waitresses to join us. And that's how we first got started. And we did our first series of performances in restaurants and cafes. It was a week-long production called Ready to Order. And it also included workshops and panel discussions about different issues. It was, you know, more than just the performance. It was a whole 7-day structure of events.
And you would actually go uninvited into restaurants? You would just appear?
No, but some of the customers thought that was what was happening. We actually asked for permission from the restaurant owner, could we do this? And most of them were happy to have us because we brought in extra audience of our own. But there were also restaurant goers that were unsuspecting that a performance was going to happen. And some of them thought that the waitresses were revolting.
the actual waitresses at that restaurant. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We're staging some kind of a protest.
Yeah. Maybe you were encouraging them to do that. Yeah. I mean, you know, some of those performances look so amazing. The other exciting thing is also that the film is executive produced by Lily Tomlin and Jane Wagner, who, of course, you know, we know Lily's work, and I think less people know how important Jane Wagner's writing and creativity has been, you know, in partnership with Lily mostly. And tell us how that came about, Sherry.
Well, I knew that I wanted to interview Lily. It was, you know, it's hard. It's hard when I'm saying it's hard. What's hard is getting celebrities involved sometimes. And you know, you have mixed feelings about that too, because you don't want it to be all about the celebrity. You want it to be about all these other art. People say, like, who's in your film? And, you know, we have a pantheon of stars of performance art, but that doesn't mean the public knows who they are. So I knew that having Lily involved with the film would really help kind of give it a more public accessibility. But my first approach was asking her to be in the film. And she actually had a relationship with the Woman's Willing. She performed quite a few times in the early years at fundraising events. In fact, once she performed with the waitresses. And so I knew she supported the building, cared about the building. And so the first thing was interviewing her, and it was just delightful to interview her. I mean, she is, you know, so funny and so charming, and we had a great interview, and she was in the film. And then I thought, you know, it would be so great if I could ask her to come on board as executive producer. That would help even more. And so I was able to reach out. And she wrote me back and said, only if it can be myself and Jane. And of course, it didn't even occur to me to ask for Jane. And I was like, perfect. Because, you know, they're both such incredible artists. And they're also a couple, and they've been out as a lesbian couple in Hollywood. And so that was important to me, because the film also, you know, has lesbian content. It is about, you know, those struggles of the early years when, you know, as a lesbian, you had to be closeted, and the Woman's Building was a place that in the early years provided a setting where women could be out. And so, and it was the place where I learned that I was a lesbian, you know, was able to come to terms with that. And then, so that's part of my arc as a character in the story. So anyway, for so many reasons, we were just so happy that they came on board, and it has helped with the visibility of the film. And I appreciate that. And, you know, other things we did that were important and I think help with the visibility of the film intergenerationally is bring in music from Billie Eilish and the Linda Lindas. We also have Fanny, of course, yeah, who's an important historic band, and Holly Near, and Frank, who spans all generations.
Right.
but yeah, to bring in that Billie Eilish and the Linda Lindas was also, you know, a good get for us to get that music in the film.
For sure. Yes, that Billie Eilish song was so perfect for that section of the film. And we're just going to let our listeners go see it for themselves.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, because I don't want to describe it. It just works so well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
It really was. I was like, brilliant choice. Yes, really, yes. Brilliant choice.
Should we say what the lyric is at least?
Or oh, sure. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, yeah, the song is Billie's song called Lunch, mm-hmm, which the title is all in caps. The lyric is, I could eat that girl for lunch.
We know which one it is. And yeah, and it's just, and also she's from LA. So, you know.
Yes.
It's, and the Linda Lindas, everyone, they're all, so it's such a perfect fit. Yeah, really great. So the exciting part that we have to talk about now is the LA premiere, which is coming up at the Getty Center on July 26th. But it's the premiere, but there's more. So let's get a little bit of info about that out to our listeners.
Yeah, it's a real special event, and the reason it's so appropriate that it's at the Getty, they're celebrating us and we're celebrating them, because we did a lot of our research at the Getty Research Institute, and we so appreciate that they house archives of the Woman's Building, of the Waitresses, Sisters of Survival, Feminist Art Workers, Mother Art, you know, Arlene Raven, Barbara T. Smith, you know, so many of the artists that are in this film have their archives at the Getty. And, you know, so that was a really important phase of the film, the research and development phase, and working with the Getty. And they just bent over backwards to help us see things. And then especially we started that research prior to the pandemic. So once we were able to go there and get, you know, our special reader cards. And but then when the pandemic happened, it was like, oh, my gosh, how can we continue this process? And they made it available to us online. So we really appreciate that. But yeah, the Getty is just doing so much for this event. There's going to be a special exhibition in the lobby of the Harold Williams Auditorium. And speaking of the Waitresses, so back then Anne made this amazing costume for a character called the Great Goddess Diana.
Yes.
Is that correct, Anne? Yes. And Anne casts the breasts in latex of all the members of the group.
Oh.
And so she made this multi-breasted costume. So she's like the goddess Diana you've seen in art history classes. And it was to comment on the role of woman as nurturer. You know, we're always being asked to nurture everyone all the time, and at the same time live in a culture in which nurturing is not really valued in a weird way. I mean, we're not paid for that labor and we're expected to do it. Anyway, when the archives of the Waitresses went into the Getty, Anne gave them that costume. Usually they do not take costumes. They do not take objects. So, and here was this thing that had been hanging in her closet for 50 years, starting to deteriorate. One of the conservators at the Getty Research Institute took on the task of restoring this costume and had to invent new methods of restoration, is in fact spoken at conferences around the world about this. That costume is going to be on display for the first time since 1978, 79, you know, it's...
Well, it was exhibited once by Jenny Sorokin, but this is the second exhibition, and this is the fully restored by Melissa Huddleston, who's the conservator.
Yes, and then there'll also be archival facsimiles of archival materials. We'll have a giant poster where people can do photo ops. We'll have the screening, and then after the screening, a conversation with Anne and myself, with Glenn Phillips, who's the senior curator. And then following that, we're going to have a reception on the plaza there, and I'm very excited. I requested they make a signature cocktail, and so they're making a cocktail called the Eyebolt, which is after the Sheila de Bretville designed necklace that she made in 1972, where she took an eyebolt and looks like a woman symbol.
Right.
Yeah. And there's going to be a special gift. Everyone in the audience is going to get one of these necklaces.
Amazing.
Yeah. We're making 400 of them. Mm-hmm. I'm giving away all our secrets.
Well, I think you're
and surprises.
You're enticing folks to come for sure. So it's July 26th. The exhibit portion opens at 1 p.m. and then the film is screening at 3 p.m. in the Harold Williams Auditorium on the Getty campus, and then a party afterwards. So what an amazing event.
Yes. And because so many people are interested in this, I would encourage people to reserve tickets. Mm-hmm. Hopefully there's still some available right away. And then also that day, come early, because the doors will open to get your sticker to get in at 1, and then the actual doors to the theater open at 2:30. And you want to be sure that you get a seat.
Amazing. Well, it's been wonderful to talk to you both. I'm very excited for the premiere. I'm bringing friends. And I've been talking to Sherry Gorky and Anne Golden about the new feature-length documentary, Acting Like Women. Congratulations, both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Lynn. Great talking to you.
You can support KPFK and our show today, Feminist Magazine. Just go to the kpfk.org website and click the donate button. It's easy. Or you can call 818-985-5735. If you do that right now, your conscience is clear. You have done it for this fund drive. And then you can go back to listening to the rest of the show. And that is just one example of the kind of story we love to highlight, plus local activists. And you can support us to keep us doing that right now. You can call 818-985-5735 or 818-985-KPFK.
It's Lupe. I listen to you guys every morning, and I've been listening to you guys since I was 19 years old. I listen to Democracy Now! And the one in the afternoon, I always forget... Background briefing. There you go. Yeah,
that one. All right, Lupe.
For KPFK Los Angeles, I'm Negwa Ibrahim. I just wanted to take a moment to talk with you all about the fund drive that we're in right now for KPFK. As you know, we are 100% community sponsored. We take no money from any sort of corporate entities. That gives us the opportunity to really talk about the issues that are affecting the world from a place of truth, and not from a place that's influenced by corporate greed, that's influenced by ulterior motives. Rather, we have the opportunity, through being community funded, through listener support, to really be able to deliver programming that is speaking truth to power. And we want to be able to continue to do that. You can make your pledge to kpfk.org/donate. Or you can call in at 818-985-5735. If you appreciate what we are about and what we're trying to do every day in collaboration with you all, please make sure to donate. Once again, you can donate at kpfk.org/donate or call in at 818-985-5735. Thanks so much for joining us. Wishing you all light, love, and peace. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. organizers and activists, we've all been in those meetings, you know, the ones where we need to make decisions as a group or to vision a larger goal. And those kinds of meetings can be a struggle. They can be filled with lots of egos and unspoken agendas. Our guest today is Adrienne Marie Brown. She's an author, a visionary thinker, and so much more. And she has a new book called Holding Change that offers a profound way to transform that process in meetings and in larger movement building in a time that we really so deeply need to shift the ways we work together and envision our future. Welcome to Feminist Magazine, Adrienne.
Thank you, Lynn. It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So many exciting and expansive ideas to talk about here, but tell our listeners a little bit about what is holding change? What can holding change look like?
You know, for years before I was formally a facilitator, I didn't know that there was a language for facilitation, for what it was. It was just something that kept happening. You know, I'd be in a meeting like, we need some synthesis, or we need an agenda, or we need, we feel stuck. Like, how can we get through this moment? And my friend, Mia Herndon, who is now part of the Emergent Strategy Collective with me, she was the first person to hire me to facilitate. And over the years, I would find myself using different terminology to try to explain what it was I was doing. And one of the emergent terminologies was holding space. People would say, we're holding space. And that was made a lot of sense to me. It's just like we're really creating and holding a space in which humans can move through the difficult with each other with as much ease as possible. And once Emergent Strategy came out, what became interesting to me was that it wasn't just that we were holding a space in which anything could happen or in which stagnation was cool. We were really trying to hold a space in which change could happen, meaning that the individuals in the space felt like they could change and that was okay, that there was room for them to change, and that the relationships between the people in the space could change, and then that the group altogether could take seriously the fact that they were trying to change the world. And that's what, you know, people who are doing social justice, people who are doing movement work, it's basically people who are like shamelessly saying, there's some things with this world that could change, and we believe in our capacity to shape that. It's also an homage to Octavia E. Butler, who in some way, I think all of my work, I always try to touch back to the stone of wisdom that she offered us with so many of her texts, but particularly in the parables, she talks about change and shaping change, being a shaper as opposed to a victim of change. And I feel like that's the call, especially right now when circumstances are so overwhelming, both externally and within movement. It's such an overwhelming thing to try to be like with each other and hold each other. But Octavia said, all that you touch, you change, and all that you change, changes you. And for facilitators and mediators, what we're doing is holding that, holding the changes that happen inevitably when we are in contact with each other, which we have to be on this tiny planet. So that's all the stuff that's happening in that title and in the book.
So much happening in the title. And a sentence that really resonated for me is, the impossibility of consensus calls us to find ways of working together in difference.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, when I first started working in movement, I naively believed that, oh, if we just all had the same information to work from, we would all reach the same conclusions, and then we would flow forward together in a heavenly, you know, Garden of Eden-like existence. And, you know, and so I became obsessed with data initially, you know, like, let's get all the information. Let's make sure we have all the information. And then, of course, you know, what happens with humans, which is we have all the same information. We reach different conclusions because we come from different walks, different socializations, different perspectives, different needs. Many of our needs are unmet, you know, and unnamed. And so we're coming into any space. The difference is actually the point. And I didn't really understand that until I started really studying the natural world more and studying the patterns of emergence and really starting to understand that in a healthy ecosystem, the biodiversity is the health, right? The number of different ways of being that can coexist is a sign of the health. And so then I started thinking, well, what if we facilitated that way? What if we facilitated where the invitation was to have as many different ways of being in the room as possible, but to find ways to align ourselves in emotion towards futures that could sustain all those differences rather than futures that could only sustain one way of being. And that has become and continues to be of deep interest to me, that because I keep changing also, like I keep changing mm-hmm. as an individual. So it's not even, it's just like each person is the same unto themselves throughout their lives. Right? It's like right. We are coming into being and we're changing constantly. We're changing each other. And so how can we don't want to achieve a consensus that requires everyone being the same way and thinking the same things. And Loretta Ross has a beautiful quote about this, which is a group of people moving the same direction and thinking the same thing is a cult. A group of people thinking different things, but moving in the same direction is a movement. And that, you know, I feel like it's such a teaching. It's like, how do we be a biodiverse movement that allows for the many different ways of being, right, to exist? I think disability justice is a great teacher of this also, right? It's like, how do we resist the idea that there's some norm that we're all supposed to achieve and some singular way of thinking that is correct? And instead, how do we embrace the fact that we're complex and we're changing?
Right. And I mean, you've partly started to answer this, but the title of the book is actually Holding Change, the Way of Emergent Strategy, Facilitation and Mediation.
Yes.
So it's part of a series based on your thinking around this idea of emergent strategy, which was your 2017 book. And it's about how we can partner with change,
yes.
right?
Yes.
So it's a very multi-layered concept, but can you tell our listeners a little bit more about that? It's so fundamental.
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, looking at the natural world, there's certain elements and there's certain principles that if you pay attention, seem to be present throughout all of the functional systems. So adaptation, intentional adaptation, being able mm-hmm. to adapt in ways that move us towards life. Life continuously moves towards life. Fractals, like there's some patterns that move from the smallest scale to the largest scale. Interdependence, right? That in nature, everything is in relationships with each other. Nothing is trying to be an individual pulling itself up by its bootstraps in spite of everyone else, you know? And so the species that are surviving have these patterns. And emergent strategy was starting to ask the question, what would it look like if humans humbled ourselves to find our patterns and to be in pattern with everything else? And, you know, the question, I don't know if you've ever sat and watched a murmuration of birds move through the sky, mm-hmm. but they're avoiding predation and there's some guidelines to how they do it. And I started thinking, like, what would it look like if our movement was like a flock of birds? What would it look like if our movement was a murmuration? If we could trust each other, if we had the right space from each other, if we understood ourselves to be a body in motion rather than a bunch of bodies at odds with each other. Mm-hmm. So emergent strategy was that first offering. And then I've been gathering different texts and ideas and thoughts that went with it. But something people kept asking me about was like, well, how do you do facilitation? Because I get a lot of positive feedback about my facilitation. People are like, oh, you're mm-hmm. so great at this. And I'm like, some of it is nature, which I put that in Holding Change. There is a nature. There's some people who I think have a nature that orients around and makes it easy to do facilitation. Like it's in us. We pay attention in a certain way. But some of it can be learned. And I think everyone should have at least a basic concept of it, a basic capacity for it, because we need it in our families, we need it in our communities, right. We need it in our workplace. Even if we're not explicitly doing organizing, we need to be able to be in right relationship with each other. So Holding Change is my offer towards that. And there's a little bow to the Taoist text, which is the Tao Te Ching, because you know, they talk about the way that can be named is not the way. Like immediately, as soon as you try to say it, you know, like trying mm-hmm. to put in a book, like here's how I do what I do. I knew that there were some things that would never be translatable or couldn't go on mm-hmm. the page. I'm still doing my best to offer the way of emergent strategy, facilitation and mediation. And to that end, I have a lot of contributors in the book, a whole series of other Black feminists who are alive and working right now who have different ways than I do. And I thought that that was a way of nodding to that, right? That it's like, it's not actually one way. The way is a complex offering of ways of adapting together, breathing together, listening to each other, leaning into each other, grieving together, growing together.
Right. And let's talk about that. You've got this deeply significant section of writings under the heading Black Feminist Wisdom.
Yes.
And it includes some of my personal favorite movement writers, thinkers, organizers. Yeah. I mean, particularly like Alexis Pauline Gums and Melchior Cyril. And you talk about being part of a lineage, right, as a facilitator. What does that lineage mean? And how do these particular writers that you invited in, how do they hold that lineage with you?
Yeah. Well, you know, for me, I think there's a moment when you recognize nothing we're doing is being done for the first time. You know, Octavia talks about, like, there's nothing new under the sun, but there are new suns. And I love that idea of, like, how do we, in our work, honor the fact that, like, there's nothing new. We learned this from ancestors. You know, when we look back at the people that we honor as organizers, really a lot of what they were doing was also facilitation, right? They were gathering, they were synthesizing, they were helping people figure out what moves could happen. That's a core piece of what it means to be moving other humans along in any shape. So some of them that are quoted in the book are Ella Baker, Fannie Lou Hamer, Harriet Tubman. These are people who I think of as a lineage of Black women, Black feminists who pointed the way, helped gather, helped listen, helped to decenter, right? They were like, it's not about me. You have to make a choice to opt into history. You have to make a choice to opt into your potential and your greatness. So for me, the lineage is there. And then I think if you look at most of those people in the book, all of them are people who I've seen name explicitly. Oh, I'm in the lineage of Audre Lorde. Adaku Yuta, who offers us the care bear, the care bear approach of these care teams that allow a room to care for itself and create a community culture of care. She says that she partnered with Harriet Tubman in her work to create Harriet's Apothecary and create a healing arm inside of movement, right? A lot of the people in the book, Alexis is one of the first people who really gave me direct access to a lot of the lineage by saying, we need to take these words of Audre Lorde, I am who I am, doing what I came to do, and we need to chant them, and we need to let them be embodied in us. Harriet Tubman said, my people are free, not will be free, but are free. You know, how do I embody that? So I think these people, one of the things that I wanted to do was shine a light on them while they're alive, right? Oh, yeah. And say, like, you are a part of Black movements, and you're part of multiracial movements, and you're part of movements for change, in large part because of these people. These people are behind the scenes, holding space, holding change, holding connections, mediating conversations, helping people create safer spaces, helping people think about security, helping people think about boundaries. Like, these are these Black women who are behind the scenes doing this work. And often they don't get seen until they've passed. And, you know, people are like, okay, now let's give them their flowers. But I'm like, they're alive. You can access their wisdom right now. You know, they're going to continue to learn and change and write, and you should be paying attention to them. So that's what felt important to me. And to be able to say, to have also expressions where it was like, it wasn't just Black feminists who were femme presenting or femme identifying, but it was a wide spectrum of Black feminists who I included in the text, because that also feels important to understand in the current moment. But I think that they are the lineage for any future generations of movement, right? We are the lineage, and I wanted to name ourselves and weave ourselves in explicitly. Like, here's what we are thinking about. Here's something that we have to offer. Here's some things that we know. That option, and because I wrote it to be consumed in a nonlinear way, I wanted to remind people that that's always possible. I especially wanted to give people the option of going and reading the Black Feminist Wisdom first. Like, it could offer a beautiful grounding, especially if you feel like, I'm pretty familiar with emergent strategy, I don't need the refresher, I can skip through that. Or if you're like, I'm coming in and I really don't have a clue about what I most need, then it's like, go to the assessments. And the assessments, my friend Zuri put those together, and they're really skillfully done, and they're easy to do. So you can just kind of get some self-assessment on, like, where is it that I might need the most skill development? And then you can just go straight there, right? If you're great at adaptation, then that might not be where you need to start. You might want to go start with nonlinearity, right? Which is for some people the most challenging aspect of emergence.
Right.
And I wanted people to be able to move through the elements in ways that made sense to them. To me, a successful book like this would be one that could, like, live in a bathroom and people could pick it up while they're in the bathroom and spend like 5 minutes and come away like, I just got something that was like, this is useful. So my dream book is always like the bathroom book or the book that people are like, I can get something no matter how much time I have to put into it. I was told early in my life, people don't read books. And yet clearly my gift is writing books. Like I'm like, I like writing books. That's the way I think. And that's the way I operate. So I'm always trying to balance like writing books that even people who don't necessarily have time for a whole book can still access and get what they needed from it.
And also, we're in this short attention span world right now.
Absolutely.
And at the same time, you're inviting folks to kind of also undo the way we've been educated, right? Which is to be linear and to follow the rules and follow the chapter headings.
Yeah. So, and like the reality is, in a space that you're facilitating, the thing that's happening, even if you have a very straightforward agenda, the thing that's happening in the space is not linear. Like, emotions are going to come up when they come up, and strategy is going to become clear when it becomes clear, and relationships are going to form, and the relationships forming will help everything else move, right? So the book is like that too. Also, there's people who are going to read this book and be like, I love Prentice, so I'm going to go read Prentice first, and then I'll go do something else. And it's like relationship does that, right? People have a relationship with some of these writers, like you said. For some people, these are their favorite writers. So I'm like, yeah, go there first. No problem. You'll still get to everything you need to get to in the book.
Adrienne Marie Brown, for joining us to talk about Holding Change. Definitely, we'll have all these links on our website.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate y'all having me on.
We're talking to Adrienne Marie Brown about her new book, Holding Change. So lineage in the sense of, it's not a past thing that you sort of look at and polish and put on a shelf, but it's current and living and woven in.
Yeah, I feel like one of the things that Indigenous worldview holds is that seven generations back, seven generations ahead,
right?
That you're actually always in the river that has directions of flow in both ways. And something about that to me is like, well, then how do I be a responsible future ancestor, as well as how do I responsibly receive what has been offered to me?
And so they're talking about things like breathing and boundaries and, you know, space, safe space or not safe space. There's actually both. And also the ways of facilitation that you offer are all deeply part of feminist thought. And yet so much we hear sort of the 101, like the equal rights and the, but I love that you bring in all of this kind of deeper and more horizontal, collaborative, those aspects of feminism that sometimes we forget, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that we can get so caught up in contending for what's the definition, what's the way that it's done, and we really can focus on the mistakes that have been made, you know, which every movement is constantly making mistakes. And I think there's, you know, my thing is, I don't think there's failure. I think there's data. And I think we can harness that data. I think we can say, oh, what did first wave feminism push and open and do? And what was the data? What did we learn? What did second wave feminism do? What did we learn? Where does intersectionality open new pathways for us? And what did we learn? Right. And to me, if you hold it that way, what we're learning all along is there are different ways for us to be leaders. There are different ways for us to be in community. And if you have a balance where all the different parts of a society are held equally in shaping those ways, all of a sudden new possibilities come into being.
Well, thank you so much, Adrienne Marie Brown, for joining us to talk about your book, Holding Change. So you can support KPFK and our show today, Feminist Magazine. Just go to the kpfk.org website and click that donate button or call 818-985-5735 or 818-985-KPFK. So during this fund drive, and we're limiting the number of interruptions and preemptions so that your favorite programs like this one can keep going on the air,
providing you with the information and the news that you can only get on KPFK. So please show your support for the station and for this approach. We want you to kind of vote with your actions and say, yeah, we want to keep having programming. But the way we'll know that is if you support us. We want to keep doing this approach to fundraising, but you can do your part by pledging online, kpfk.org, or call 818-985-5735. If it's been a while since you last donated, even if you've never donated before, if you've been listening but you've never donated before, there's no time like the present. Don't procrastinate. We want to go forward. So do it now and make a generous donation, as generous as you can, to keep KPFK part of your daily life, to keep Feminist Magazine part of your weekly life. We're in challenging times, and your contribution really is vitally important. So we thank you for your help and support. We thank you on behalf of all of the other listeners and all of us right here at KPFK. We work as a collective of diverse voices and contributors. And like you heard in that last segment, that whole thing of diverse voices is not just a set of differences, but a way to kind of come together, collaborate, and make something bigger and better. And that's what we do on our show, Feminist Magazine. And that's what KPFK does as well. So it means that there's a bunch of viewpoints, giving you, our listeners, all kinds of perspectives, stories, and guests every week. And it goes across generations too. We mentor new contributors here on Feminist Magazine. We love doing that. We love teaching radio skills like interviewing, engineering, and editing to young college students, to grassroots feminists from different communities across the city. And all of us who are part of the show are activists in different communities around LA, but we give our time and sweat to FemMag because we believe in radio. Go to kpfk.org and click donate if you want this to keep happening and these kinds of stories, this kind of work to be there every week for you. We're inviting you to give $100 or be a sustainer. And that is amazing to keep KPFK sustainable. You give us your credit card, you say how much you want to donate every month, and then it's automatically taken out. You don't have to worry about it. We have a sustainable base that we can work from, that we can build from. We have all kept going for you. So show us a little love, won't you? Go to kpfk.org and click that donate button right now to support the show. And speaking of love, we love getting feedback from listeners about the show. We've been getting great feedback on our programming during this fund drive. It's part of an ongoing wave of being part of making change, and we're happy to support that. Thanks to all our guests and contributors today. And now is your last chance to support KPFK in this hour, in the Feminist Magazine hour. So if you like what you just heard on Feminist Magazine, please support us to keep doing that. Go to kpfk.org and click the donate button or call 818-985-5735. And thank you.
That's what is good about KPFK. You do get it that it's the people, not the manufacturers that are selling us all the cheap soap and toothpaste and general unhealthy junk, but it's really information that is quite usable. I'm Joyce Clark from Bellingham, Washington. I listen to KPFK as much as I possibly can, and I do support it.
KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and if you're in Bellingham or anywhere else in the world, www.kpfk.org.
Tune in on Tuesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. for Phil and Ted's Sexy Boomer Show as they present Treasure Island, A Telling for the New World, an audio adventure in 8 chapters. This unabridged adaptation of the classic novel by Robert Louis Stevenson resets the story in the bayous, the port of New Orleans, and the Caribbean at the end of the golden age of piracy in 1828. starring Keith David as Long John Silver.
The devil himself would have feared to go to sea with that man.
John Goodman as Billy Bones.
If you see a man with one leg a-walking up to this here inn, you'll tell old Captain Billy here what's what, won't you, Jim?
And Glenn Turman as the storyteller.
That night, a hurricane hit the bayou, and I had a bad dream.
With original score by Taj Mahal. That's Treasure Island, a telling for the new world,